We see that during the pandemic in Sri Lanka, there was the criminalization of many COVID-19 patients. We also saw many protesters arrested with reasons cited as the pandemic and the quarantine regulations. And so we see that now as well, with many protesters being criminalized and being arrested for their participation in peaceful protest.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pretty Good Podcast, Digital Rights in the Asia Pacific with Engage Media. I am Red.
And I'm Sarah.
And welcome to this episode, which is the first of a two-part series where we talk about the pandemic of control, a series of articles that aims to further public discourse on the rise of digital authoritarianism in the Asia Pacific amid COVID-19. This series is an initiative by Engage Media in partnership with Common Edge. On this episode, we focus on how the pandemic has driven governments in South Asia, particularly Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, to devise ways of managing their citizens and controlling information and activities using digital technologies.
And joining us today from Bangladesh is Zayed Siddiqui, an award-winning independent filmmaker, human rights defender, and development communications professional based in Dhaka. And from Sri Lanka, we are joined by Harindrini Correa, currently a legal officer at Hashtag Generation and an attorney at law who holds a Bachelor of Laws degree from the University of London. So Zayed and Harindrini, thank you very much for joining us on today's episode. Before I get to asking you both a very serious question, I want to toss this first to Red. So Red, in introducing the Pandemic of Control series earlier, you highlighted how the COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated the authoritarian use of digital technologies worldwide, and especially so in our region. Could you tell us more about the origins of this series and its importance?
We at Engage Media have been noticing a worrying trend. Of course, COVID-19 happened around the world, and there were restrictions, there were interventions that were done by the government purportedly to keep people safe from the pandemic. But we noticed that there was overreach. People were being surveilled more, digital technology was being used instead of just helping people. It's being used to control them, to keep them silent, to control the narratives that were going on in media, both mainstream and new media. Only certain narratives were being represented and other voices were being censored, essentially. What's increasingly worrying is how progressives tended to be okay with this. People who normally are on the side of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of information, they kind of let their guards down. And now we are in a situation where the controls that were enacted by governments have been abused by bad actors in many ways. And this is what we're going to hear about. I'm having more conversations about these threats, these ongoing situations. It's a way that we hope to encourage people to be more vigilant about this ongoing situation and hopefully to put a stop to the controls and to give freedoms back to the people.
So thank you for that introduction, Red. And we're very keen to hear how exactly this pandemic of control is manifesting itself in countries in South Asia. So for Zayed and Harindrini, I pose two questions to each of you. First, could you give us a brief description of your article on this? And two, could you answer what are some of the biggest ways that the pandemic of control has reached your country? So Zayed, I pass this to you first.
If I talk about my article was about, you know, the use of a Digital Security Act, a legislation that impacted the whole sphere of the society during pandemic and even before that. This was a continuation, and pandemic came as a blessing for that continuation of authoritarianism. And also part of my piece focused on mass surveillance and as well how information was controlled, and at the time a movement passes was introduced to control the physical movements, though there were partial responses from the government that controlling the critics and the political opponents as well as CSO communities in the country, and giving leverage to the political supporters of current government. So that was quite divided response. That also impacted the situation of pandemic in our country.
Thank you, Zayed. And for you, Harindrini?
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you for having me on this podcast. So my article focused on the use of the digital space as a tool by the government under former President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to further an authoritarian agenda. It looked at state-sponsored disinformation against the Muslim community in particular, a highly militarized COVID-19 response, and crackdown on dissent. This includes the misuse and weaponization of existing law and threat to also bring in new laws. And this sort of response to the pandemic has also been seen in post-pandemic times, and in how the government, after the government of former President Rajapaksa, has also responded to dissent in particular.
For both of you, have there been any updates to your article since it was published?
The CSOs in our country, and particularly journalist community, and if I say all the common citizens in our country who are in a state of fear, you know, a fear was spread through using the Digital Security Act. So the whole country is in a state of self-censorship. So in that sense, everybody was talking from their side, writing articles about abolishing DSA, and government was not listening to that appeals. So the response was like CSO communities has appreciated the thing and shared widely, but there was no particular response from the government, because government is listening that question every day from every side of the society, written in newspapers and physical protest agitations, but not listening. Because if I say about the nature of the Digital Security Act, it is named as Digital Security Act. It was thought from the dimension of security, not from the dimension of freedom. So CSOs were telling that if the government is saying this law is enacted for countering the cyber crimes and related those like defamations and hurting somebody's sentiment online, to tackle that. But you know, the name was in spite of Digital Freedom Act, it was Digital Security Act. So it provides security not to the citizens, as it's evident from the applications for last few years. It provides security to the government and its policies. And when somebody comes as a critics to their policies and activities, they applied it to all sphere of the society. So now, you know, if we need to understand the nature of that application of Digital Security Act, people usually talk about their rights set their demands going either physically or virtually. But in our country, there was a trend coming for last 2-3 decades, so even before that, that the physical space was shrinking gradually in our country. So by maybe of abolishing the spaces, public spaces that is available for people to go for agitation and demonstration, and also with the laws, then people moved to talk in the digital space. So government then thought of, you know, controlling that space too. That's why Digital Security Act gradually, it was earlier called Information Technology Act, then with huge protection, huge controversy from the CSOs and global community, it was then banned and spilled into new sections and newly enacted with Digital Security, named as Digital Security Act. That is even more odds than the earlier Information Communication Act. So I would like to say that suddenly the controlling of digital space in our country doesn't happen. Because this is a continuation of shrinking the physical space and then people moving to talk on the digital space. And then this space is also under control. And then pandemic time arrived. And that time, this pandemic has leveraged, it gives more aids to the government for controlling more. So it was already happening in the country. And then pandemic came as a blessing for the government for throttling bias more controlling the critics and the CSOs of the, especially handling the COVID policies.
In Sri Lanka, post-pandemic and post-lockdowns, we've actually seen a beginning with small neighborhood vigils and moving on to an Occupy movement where large numbers of protesters camped outside the presidential secretariat in the main city and were there for over 100 days. So this was a very large, peaceful assembly with several parts of it, including a people's university, a library, a legal aid center, music and various creative forms of protest and dissent were used. And so with this peaceful assembly and this massive uprising of people, we also witnessed the former president forced to flee the country and then resign from overseas. And post with the transition of power further on, we've seen with the new government under President Ranil Wickremesinghe, that there has been a crackdown on protesters, particularly those who were part of this peaceful assembly. It was an organic uprising of people across the country, members of the public. But prominent persons who have been involved with the protests have been arrested. We've also noticed abductions in the last week or so, especially of student activists. We see that during the pandemic in Sri Lanka, there was the criminalization of many COVID-19 patients. And we also saw many protesters arrested, cited as the pandemic and the quarantine regulations. And so we see that now as well, with many protesters being criminalized and being arrested for their participation in peaceful protest.
I am seeing here there is a common theme with both your stories, which is the censorship of critical voices, especially whether it regards the economic situation like in Sri Lanka or the pandemic response and the law in Zayed's case. Would you both still say then that this climate of fear, especially self-censorship, as Zayed had mentioned also in his article, still persists? And if so, what are the ways that people are fighting back against that?
The law is... it tightens the norms, so that's why people fear to talk. Every corner of the society is impacted by this law. If I say, from journalists, from the academicians, writers, bloggers, filmmakers, even school-going children, so not spared out of that law. Even bowels means spiritual singers who have no connection with politics or anything. They just sing, and they were even arrested under this law. Political opponents is a common matter, but I'm saying in the example, a school-going boys, 15-year-old boy, and even bowels, who has no connection with all these political issues or anything, they were even not spared under this law. So if I say some statistics, from 2012 to 2020, according to the government's cybercrime tribunal, there were around 2,000 cases filed under this law, DSA, and only 2% of them was ever convicted. So it shows the trend that this law is a tool for harassment. This law is used to throttle the voice of the critics. If somebody talk about policies of the government taken, there are taken under this law and harassed. So that's why it created overall a fear. If I say about press freedom index in our country, you will say Bangladesh stand this year 162nd out of 180 countries in the world. So it's lowest in South Asia. So Bangladesh press freedom is really on crack for many years, for many decades. So everybody put self-censorship while going to speak. They choose which word to speak and which word not to speak, and even in writing and speaking everywhere, even in social media. If I say about the Freedom House score on freedom on the net, Bangladesh scored 39 out of 100. So it's a partly free country. But you know, if last year it scored 40, so it shows that gradually it's declining, you know, it's becoming worsen. It's worsening day by day in our country. When we go, even an ordinary citizen in social media, if he goes to write anything about government's policies, not only pandemic, many other issues. I already said that it was a continuation. Pandemic was a continuation. That pandemic came as a blessing on the already happening situation. You know, first they have shrinking the physical space, then people move to digital space, and they enacted ICT Act and then Digital Security Act. That also throttled the voice, that shrinking the space unprecedentedly in on the digital space in our country. So you see, self-censorship, that's why even as a filmmaker, me and our filmmaking community thinks twice what to tell, what to show in the screenplay, that government will, if my film will be banned, I cannot release my film. So even same for the singers, for the writers, many books were banned many times in a book, from the book fair stalls were banned. So this is overall an environment of fear in our country, that specifically for freedom of expression.
I think connecting with what Zayed said, when we look at Sri Lanka as well, we've seen in the past pre-pandemic short story writers, poets being penalized for their creative expression and their expression of their ideas. So we see that this fear and self-censorship, which is in Sri Lanka, is also part of the larger picture of the misuse of laws, the weaponization of existing laws. And so pre-pandemic, we saw the misuse of laws such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights Act, which was used on the pretext of preventing incitement to violence, actually used to curtail freedom of expression. And then during the pandemic, we saw provisions of the penal code being used to stifle any criticism against President Rajapaksa and any decisions that the government made about the pandemic response. And with that also is the surveillance as part of that crackdown on dissent. And also part of the pandemic response with the misuse of law was against those asserting their right to protest during the pandemic. And then post-pandemic, right now, for example, we are in a state of emergency. And that state of emergency, again, is being used to also crack down on dissent. And so with all of the ways that the law is being used to suppress dissent, we see that, yes, there is fear and there is self-censorship. And also, particularly with the fact that that law enforcement and government agents surveil and are very aware of certain social media spaces. So actually during the mass protests, we saw that there was a social media activist who was abducted originally, and then because of consistent intervention, he was found to be in police custody. So this was one of the people who created a Facebook group, which called many people to come for protest. So we see that people who post on social media, post pictures, post information and ideas, that they are being targeted, and there is that fear of posting. But also with the latter part of your question, like with this mass uprising, we see that many members of the public, especially the youth and also civil society, are also rising up against this suppression in many ways. So from protesting to using tools such as Right to Information Act, with strategic litigation, with different ways people are attempting to stand up against this suppression.
Thank you so much, both. So on one side, we have the government weaponizing laws. As Zayed put it, it's been a blessing to authoritarian tendencies, what happened in COVID-19. So on one side, we have that. On the other, we have citizens trying to fight it using that strategic litigation, freedom of information, and so on. Like, how do you see this playing out going forward? Like, if the trend continues the way it has been continuing, what do you think is going to happen, say, in a few years' time as this situation continues to develop?
Okay, thank you. If I say about what will happen in future, but before that, I didn't mention how DSA was used instrumentally during the COVID time. So I want to say that, and then I want to expand to the future what will happen. So you see, gradually, in 2018, DSA was enacted, and gradually we're seeing the trend that the use is increasing day by day. So in pandemic time, in 2 years, if I say some data, there were around 2,244 cases were filed during COVID, like from March 2022, April 2022. And of them, 822 were cases were filed. And among them, you see most of them, 31% is political opponents, like politicians, and 25% of them are journalists. So during the COVID-19, for reporting of, you know, late lockdowns, less case detection rates, less testing and vaccination rates, and also relief embezzlement during the COVID-19, there were a lot of reporting. And for that, ruling party leaders, ruling party supporters, as well government agencies crack down on journalists specifically. There are a lot of examples that I've mentioned in my writing piece, but I want to say some of the cases, as Harindini mentioned, two or three cases. In our country, that there is also mass surveillance going on. Bangladesh government has bought mass spying spywares like Pegasus and many others that is out in that was published in Al Jazeera reports. We have seen much earlier, before the 2018 elections. So what I earlier said, that was a continuation, and pandemic came as a blessing of that continuation of rising authoritarianism and controlling the online space as well. So there are people's private chats, WhatsApp messaging, and messenger messaging on Facebook was tracked, surveilled, and like that, you know, Mustaq Ahmed is a writer, blogger in our country who died in detention because of the torture. So he was arrested under DSA Act, and some two, three other highlighted cases that I mentioned in my piece, Dr. Minhaj Mannan and Didarul Alam Bhuiya, the two of the activists, they were all together were detained on the same case because they were chatting. They found the chatting that they were talking about government's response and government handling of the COVID. So these private chats were also surveilled, tracked, and they were picked up and they were put behind the bar using this Digital Security Act. And they were denied bails for months after months, many times, finally, they were released after 6 months, 8 months, without any proof of conspirating against the state, or for that conviction, they were picked up under the law. So this kind of thing was happening, like mass surveillance. So to protect, you know, Digital Security Act was originally, government says that enacted to tackle people's security in digital space, but it is used against them. So there were no law to protect personal data personal safety on digital space, on online space for the general citizens. Data Protection Act is being drafted in our country, but still the general citizens, CSOs, and journalists, and ordinary citizens of the country still in doubt that this law will be either used for their protection or against it. So there's a big country, confusion. Not confusion, you know, it's a fear created because of the application, the ruthless application of DSA. So everybody fears. And the future, we don't know, because there were a lot of calls from editors' guilds in our country, journalists, from the student communities, from the activists, from writers, filmmakers, from every part of the society. Everybody appealed, agitated on the street to abolish the draconian law, Digital Security Act. But government has not responded to that, because you know this law provides security to the government, not to the citizens. The future for Bangladeshi citizen and you know for CSOs and the journalists is to keep protesting and keep be wise and be smart and saying things, because we have to choose words. We have to think before choosing words. Either I will be caught in DSA or not. So be smart about and smart about using the words and continue the agitation. That if we have a good data protection law, at least that can safeguard the citizens in our country in the digital space.
When looking at the future and what we expect, so sort of looking at the trends and what we're seeing currently to sort of be able to predict as well. So one thing is we see that there's been this constant conversation for the last few years, and it has come up again recently about regulating social media or laws against disinformation. So this is a space where especially civil society and lawyers and activists are monitoring the situation to see how these plans come about in terms of the attempts to bring in new legislation. So that's one space there where we have to be aware of what's happening and make sure that at that time, if you know something is brought, that we can counter that and bring it before the Supreme Court. The other thing is with surveillance and digital tools. We've seen that during the protests, there were observations of the use of drone technology, observation of stingrays. And this is all technology that we really hadn't seen in sort of large protests, public spaces. And then once we saw this, then we were aware that there are these types of technologies. So the other thing, the challenge there is actually understanding what sort of digital technologies the state, the government actually has, because even with the right to information, we have legitimate concerns of national security, which could restrict the amount of information we are provided with. So that's another area. With internet shutdowns, what we've seen is that recently there was an attempt to not just to actually prohibit data usage, in which case then there would not be the use of VPNs possible. And then we see that there, because of a lack of awareness, sometimes even of VPNs amongst different segments of society, in general, public would not be aware of how to respond if there was this other step of switching off data usage. So sort of digital rights and really creating awareness of digital skills and the use of digital technologies will help to counter, you know, increasing use of the digital space by governments, because we need, as the public needs to be aware of their digital rights and, you know, navigating securely and safely digital spaces.
So at Engage Media, we have observed that people who are normally quite critical of the government, who are very much on the side of defending freedom of expression, of being against surveillance, being pro-privacy, these same people, some of them haven't been as critical of the government and have even been agreeing with government measures that enact authoritarian measures. So is this something that you have observed in your countries, where people who are normally on the side of such freedoms haven't been as critical of authoritarian measures? And if so, how have you responded to it?
What I would like to say in that point is self-censorship again. You know, already there was a culture of self-censorship in our country, and it is worsening day by day. So people, even who are critical of government policies and responses for pandemic response and other issues, everybody thinks twice what to say and what not to say. Even who is, because they think I might fall in, you know, danger or that legal tool might be used against me, because a state is so much powerful against a few citizens. They can harass you in many ways. But in our country, there is a problem that we cannot separate state and government from each other, you know, because the government's action becomes state action. So then came the point or question of defamation or, you know, conspiracy against the state. Because of both, like, you know, unclear definitions of Digital Security Act sections that they easily can use, that if you be critics of government policies and government's failing of handling the situations, then they easily can interpret that this person, this critical voices, this dissents are defaming the country, they are conspirating against the country. This is how many of the highlighted cases that law was used. So, you know, this kind of examples set by the government that spreaded a fear, that fear you cannot imagine if you don't live in the country. So for that fear, even the critical voices think wisely, use their words very carefully, write very carefully, and speak on the television talk shows very carefully, that government cannot directly catch them under this law. So that is a situation, because we have no other way. If you speak, because your physical space has gone already, your physical space is restricted with different laws and it's divided, that there are a lot of people cannot mobilize together for agitation. Then you remain the virtual space where people used to speak, but the pick and punish using that draconian law has also throttled the voice in on the online space. So you have very limited space, both physically and online. So you have to be wise, you know.
So like in your context, Harindrini, do you observe that some progressive voices have been agreeing with the government? Or is it like in Zayed's case where they're just afraid to express dissent?
When looking at criticism against the government in terms of during the time of the pandemic in particular, it's important to understand the context within which that government was placed. So the president, the former president Rajapaksa, was elected with an overwhelming majority. And within sort of mid-2020, we also have parliament being elected, which 2/3 of the members of parliament were from the president's political party. And so within this space where overwhelmingly government power, state power is this particular party, especially with things like the militarized response to COVID-19, we see less criticism, or we see more of an acceptance of this militarized response, given the discussions about the role of the military, and also sort of individuals from the military who were placed in positions of decision making in the COVID response. The second point in terms of criticism of the government is also looking at the narratives, and particularly the state narratives. And this is where we see state disinformation playing a huge role, and also looking at the narratives that are presented to the public by private media, which is also affiliated with those who are or who were in governments. And we actually have sort of media ownership, sort of monitoring agencies or attempts, because we see that sort of the narratives that are released in public or that members of the public are privy to, these narratives are very important in forming that mindset. And so we see a lot of the patients who were criminalized for violating the COVID-19 regulations. One of those cases was actually a father who was placed in quarantine and then had to go out and look for food for his family. And when he left to look for food, he was sort of accosted by law enforcement, and there was a struggle, and that led to his death, actually. So you see that when you look into these individual examples of people who violated COVID-19 regulations, that the story is not so straightforward, but we actually had media, state and private, that was displaying on news and all of these things that these COVID-19 patients had violated the regulations, that they were criminals. And so this narrative also does then have a place in there being less criticism of responses that the government takes.
In our country, already intellectuals and CSOs were divided in two parts. There were people or intellectuals or academicians who were supporting the governments and the government development endeavors with the statistics. The critics who used to say the things in the private forums, they feared to speak that in the public forums because of that Digital Security Act. So what I would say, there were state disinformations as well and limiting informations during the COVID-19 Act regarding the test cases, because showing less means less panic or what government tells. So, but the critics were pointing on their capacity and the way they handled the case detections and lockdowns, because lockdowns was given it was partial responses, like what I earlier mentioned, giving lockdown to especially for the activities of CSOs and for the political opponents, and giving leverage to the favoring people like supporters and supporters programs. So this kind of disinformation was even supported by some intellectuals, academicians on media for creating public perception. Although our vaccination rate is good, government handled it later on well, but before that there were a lot of corruptions that I mentioned in my article. So when journalists were reporting these corruptions regarding to the limiting information on testing and vaccinations, buying a vaccine with much higher rates and related corruptions, so then they were punished with Digital Security Act. So there are thousands of examples.
Thank you so much for your answers, Harindrini and Zayed. Now that you've heard from each other, what is your response to each other's stories? What do you think your country's situations have in common? And what makes your contexts unique?
The difference with Sri Lanka is the recent mass uprising of people and the very creative forms of dissent and public assembly that were on display. Definitely, I believe that it's very important for us to have regional conversations to be able to share and to learn from each other. And there are many lessons that we can take from all of our experiences look at what tools that we can use and what tools work in other countries, then maybe what tools we can apply to our own context.
I'm agreeing with Harindrini. The difference between Bangladesh and Sri Lanka is there is an uprising there. But in our country, we cannot go to the street. So that's a big problem that I already mentioned. The physical space is divided. And with using of different laws and pick and punish, like if you organize an agitation, so because of the surveillance, the state authorities already know that there are going to be a protest in tomorrow or day after on that space. So that space has either these people were neutralized before going there. So this kind of problem we do face, that's the difference. So but ultimately you have to go to the street for agitating and for saying about your rights. So what we can do is in future regionally we can talk about each other's and learn from the lessons, and in regional forums we have to speak more about our situations and get experiences from others and that apply that in our context. In Bangladesh, people are very less aware about the digital rights, but a huge number of people, around 104 million people, use internet currently in our country, but very few of them. I don't know, there is no statistics, but I assume that less than 10-20% is much aware about the digital rights and using the digital space safely. So we have to even aware people and increase the dialogue among regional CSS and like-minded people, that we get a space to fight the state's muzzling hand.
When looking at the future and post-pandemic, I think the current government under President Wickremasinghe will also need to take into account everything that we've been talking about and the experience during the pandemic and immediately post-pandemic, where that repression actually resulted in this massive uprising that resulted in his predecessor being chased off. And so the current government in Sri Lanka, in terms of international commitments, in terms of domestic commitments, will need to examine. The current government in Sri Lanka will need to keep in mind international commitments in the protection of civil and political rights, particularly the freedom of expression and the socio-economic rights of all of our people, in terms of how they will move forward, and in particular how they will respond to criticism of their decisions and measures that are taken right now.
Thank you for sharing, Zayed and Harindrini. And definitely these conversations are still ongoing and won't stop anytime soon, especially as the pandemic of control that we've been talking about continues to this day, and a lot of what has been established and precedents set during the pandemic are still going to be felt in future laws and in future actions by our respective governments. So I also want to touch on what Zayed said on the need to talk to each other and keep those regional conversations open. Part of that is also learning about what is happening in each other's countries and supporting one another. So this is our invitation to you to read the rest of the articles in the Pandemic of Control series, where we have articles not just in South Asia, not just Zayed's and Harindrini's, but also others where similar things are also happening. And this is one of the ways in which we can be more informed about ways that other countries are experiencing perhaps similar things to us, and how we can also support each other through that. So with that, again, I invite you to read the rest of the series and to look forward to part two of this Pandemic of Control podcast series. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Harindrini and Zayed, for joining us today. That was Zayed Siddiqui from Bangladesh and Harindrini Correa from Sri Lanka. For more articles on how the pandemic of control is affecting different countries in the Asia-Pacific region, we invite you to visit engagemedia.org/pandemic-control. This is where you will find the rest of the Pandemic of Control series. For the second part of this podcast episode on the Pandemic of Control, stay tuned to engagemedia.org/podcast, where you will be able to listen to not only this episode, but other episodes in the Pretty Good Podcast series. You can also listen to this podcast anywhere you listen to your podcasts. And with that, stay tuned for the next episode.